Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present William Beeman, author of The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs, who assesses the rising tension between Iran, the U.S., and Israel. ACLU attorney Danielle Tully, who explains why her group has filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the new Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, recently passed by Congress and signed into law by President Bush. And Cecil Corbin Mark of We Act, a Harlem, New York-based environmental justice group, who explains why he supports both a carbon tax and cap as a fairer, more transparent way to reduce CO2 emissions. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Luis Moreira Ocampo, is seeking the arrest of Sudan's president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, for masterminding a campaign of genocide in Darfur. Ocampo says 35,000 Darfur residents were killed by Sudanese troops and their militia, the Janjaweed, while over 2.5 million people in the region have fled their homes as a result of a deliberate campaign of rape, hunger, and fear. In recent years, United Nations tribunals have charged sitting presidents such as Liberia's Charles Taylor and Serbia's Slobodan Milosevic with war crimes. The ICC has come under international criticism for putting the UN peacekeeping force in Darfur at risk of more attacks. Charges against Bashir may also damage any chance of progress at peace talks among rival militias and the government. The Sudanese government does not recognize the ICC and has refused to turn over two other named suspects in war crimes investigations. John Dicker of Human Rights Watch told Reuters charging President al-Bashir for the hideous crimes in Darfur shows no one is above the law. Abortion politics has intruded into the effort to expand funding for the Indian Health Service, which provides medical care for 2 million Native Americans. Last winter, Louisiana Senator David Vitter placed an amendment into the IHS funding bill that restricts abortion services. Vitter voted against the final IHS bill, even after his amendment was accepted. Advocates for Native American health care fear the amendment may threaten the expansion of health services. The IHS bill is still pending in the House of Representatives. The Indian Health Service is already restricted by the Hyde Amendment, which only allows for federal funding of abortions in the case of rape, incest, or endangerment of a pregnant woman's life. Advocates say the Vitter Amendment would limit the incest exemption to women under 18 years old. Sharon Asatoyer of the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center told the news magazine In These Times, "It is a race-based amendment because it is trying to reduce our right to access abortion more than any other race of women in the country." The White House has decided to delay any action on regulating greenhouse gases until after George W. Bush leaves office. Under pressure from a 2007 Supreme Court ruling to regulate carbon emissions, the Environmental Protection Agency has submitted a draft proposal to the White House, which was rejected. As a result, the EPA proposed more public hearings. The Supreme Court ordered the EPA to determine if human health and welfare were harmed by greenhouse gases coming from cars, trucks, power plants, and other sources of emissions. If the EPA concluded that human health was harmed, it would have forced automakers and utilities to reduce carbon emissions. The 588-page EPA draft report stated reducing greenhouse gases could save the U.S. economy over $2 trillion over 30 years. After a White House-influenced revision, the savings were reduced to $830 billion by assuming the price of gasoline would be $2 a gallon, half of its current price. Joan Claybrook of Public Citizen blasted the administration's handling of the situation when she told the Los Angeles Times, "The interference of the White House in this process is unconscionable, and its decision to run out the clock is a disgrace." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu. We'll be right back.
Iranian tests of short- and long-range missiles on July 9th were just the latest in a series of actions by Iran, the U.S., and Israel, signaling rising tensions which could lead to conflict. Iran's test of 9 missiles during war games, demonstrating its ability to retaliate against any future attack, came after Israeli military exercises in late June, seen by many as a practice run for possible airstrikes against Iran's nuclear research facilities. President Bush maintains that all options, including military action, are still on the table in regard to Washington's belief that Iran is engaged in developing a nuclear weapons program, all while U.S. aircraft carrier groups cruise the Persian Gulf. On June 6th, Israeli Transportation Minister and former Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz was quoted as saying that an attack on Iran was unavoidable if the Islamic Republic didn't stop its development of nuclear weapons. Added to all this is Seymour Hersh's New Yorker article titled Preparing the Battlefield, which alleges that the Bush administration is currently engaged in covert actions inside Iran designed to weaken and destabilize the Tehran government. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Professor William Beeman, chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and author of the book The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs. He assesses the rising tension between Iran, the U.S., and Israel, and the danger that conflict could erupt in the last 6 months of the Bush presidency.
A couple of months ago, the Israelis also bombed a target in Syria that they claimed was a Syrian nuclear base, possibly funded by North Korea. The photographs that were released by the United States and by Israel turned out to be completely photoshopped. They were utterly false. And it's now thought that that this, too, was a practice run for bombing of Iranian nuclear facilities. And we just recently had in the news a White House spokesperson saying that it's possible that Iran might have funded this nuclear facility, which, in fact, didn't exist. So we have a very serious campaign that's going on the part of some elements within the Bush administration, plus neoconservatives who have been talking about attacking Iran for some length of time. And there's a real battle going on between the people who want to launch a military attack against Iran. They seem to be centered in Vice President Dick Cheney's office, and the State Department, or at least some elements in the State Department, that are favoring a diplomatic solution to the differences that exist between Iran and the United States. Very important to understand that the United States and Iran are still not talking to each other in any direct fashion. All of the negotiations that are taking place between Iran and Western powers are taking place with nations other than the United States. And what we see on a regular basis is that every single time that Iran seems to come close or begins to try to improve its relations with the West, the groups that really want to attack Iran and want to have a good reason that they can sell to the American public for attacking Iran immediately gin up these accusations against Iran and try to sabotage the more positive diplomatic routes that are being taken toward improving these relationships. Let me point out that the most pernicious situation right now that American citizens should be aware of is a couple of resolutions in Congress and the Senate. House Concurrent Resolution 362, which has been sponsored by Representative Gary Ackerman of Long Island and Mike Pence of Indiana. It calls for an embargo, an economic embargo, and also a blockade of the Straits of Hormuz, through which most of the oil of the world passes. The resolution was actually written by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, and given to these congressmen to promulgate in Congress. It has unfortunately garnered more than 200 sponsors in Congress, most of whom have not read it at all. Although it has no force in law, it is an extremely dangerous resolution in Congress, and I urge all of your listeners to call their congressperson and ask them to withdraw their support from this resolution. It is the prelude to a military conflict with Iran.
Professor Beeman, how would you characterize the Iranian missile test last week? Was that a reaction to threats made by the U.S. and Israel?
Really difficult not to read this as a show of Iran's defensive force, based on the two Israeli open, very overt, open military operations that were announced as being a practice run for an attack on Iran. Also, this House Concurrent Resolution 362 had been introduced into Congress before the Iranian test took place.
What do you make of Iran's nuclear program? There are accusations in the West that this is a nuclear weapons program. Iran maintains this is a civilian nuclear energy program. The national estimate released by the U.S. intelligence agencies collectively last December reached the conclusion that Iran may have started a military nuclear weapons program, but ended it several years ago. Where does the truth lie here in your view?
I think that nobody has been able to prove that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. No one. The United States has no evidence. The IAEA has no evidence. No European power has any evidence. And when the United States government or President Bush, or in fact in this House concurrent resolution 362, when they simply assert that Iran has a nuclear weapons program, it is an empty assertion. And what the form of rhetoric that this always takes is that Iran must not be allowed to obtain nuclear weapons. This is a piece of false rhetoric that implies that Iran actually has a nuclear weapons program. The NIE in 2007 demonstrated that there was no evidence. The Lawrence Livermore laboratories, nuclear laboratories, have performed a very complete examination of the evidence that we have about Iran's nuclear program. They don't believe that Iran is going to even have enough nuclear enriched uranium to even power a power plant until sometime in the next decade. And you can't make a weapon without processing the nuclear material through a power plant. Then you must take the residue from the power plant and then put it through another process in order to weaponize it. Then you have to fit it to a weapon. That's a long, long, long time before Iran could even conceivably have this nuclear program. And at the same time, Iran is sitting next to Pakistan, which has existing nuclear weapons and terrorist organizations resident within the country. And nobody seems to care about Pakistan or about the danger that is that's involved with Pakistan. They focus and fetishize and obsess about the Iranian situation, which is way, way down the road.
That was William Beeman, chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and author of the book The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs. Read Beeman's articles online at wbeeman.com. On July 3rd, President Bush signed into law an amended version of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which grants sweeping new powers to the executive branch, allowing wholesale collection of Americans' overseas phone calls and emails. The measure, passed by the Senate on July 2nd, also provides retroactive immunity to telephone companies that participated in Mr. Bush's warrantless wiretap program that will likely end pending lawsuits filed against the companies for their role in the illegal spy program. The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the FISA legislation on July 10th. Joining the lawsuit were The Nation magazine, on behalf of two of their contributing writers, Chris Hedges and Naomi Klein, and other plaintiffs, including Amnesty International USA, Human Rights Watch, Global Fund for Women, Penn American Center, Washington Office on Latin America, Service Employees International Union, and several private attorneys. The groups and individuals signing onto the suit believe their ability to perform work, which relies on confidential communications, will be greatly compromised by the new FISA law. The defendants in the case are the Attorney General of the United States, Michael Mukasey, John M. Mike McConnell, Director of National Intelligence, and Lieutenant General Keith Alexander, Director of the National Security Agency and Chief of the Security Service. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with ACLU staff attorney Danielle Tully, one of five lawyers working on the case, who explains why the lawsuit was filed and how the FISA law undermines important protections in the U.S. Constitution.
In 2005, the New York Times disclosed that the president had authorized the National Security Agency to intercept international phone calls and emails without going to the FISA court, without probable cause, so long as the National Security Agency believed that someone on the phone might have some relation to terrorism. Now, that was a huge expansion of surveillance, and that's the backdrop for this challenge, because what the FISA Amendments Act has done is essentially to legalize that type of surveillance and go even further. And it goes further by allowing dragnet surveillance of communications that are wholly unconnected to terrorism and with very, very little judicial oversight. And our clients in the case are prominent journalists, attorneys, The Nation, labor and human rights organization, all of which engage in international communications that are essential to their work on a day-to-day basis. And so all of them essentially engage in the types of communications that are subject to surveillance under this new law. And our biggest challenge to this is that the law simply isn't reasonable. It doesn't provide enough protections to Americans' individual privacy and speech rights, and it doesn't have sufficient checks and balances to prevent abuse. And this is what the Constitution requires in order to engage in surveillance.
Danielle, talk a little bit about the violations you feel are embodied in this law when it comes to the Constitution's First and Fourth Amendment, the free speech and privacy elements of the Constitution.
Right. Well, with regard to the First Amendment, you know, what we're seeing with the surveillance is the dragnet nature of it, the widespread nature of it, really chills speech and communication. One of the things that is most important to our democracy is the free flow of ideas. And when you have individuals and organizations that are concerned that their day-to-day international communications will be subject to surveillance, people are not comfortable talking. And that in and of itself is a real problem. With regard to the Fourth Amendment, you know, American people have a reasonable expectation in the privacy of their communications. And this does not trump everything. But in order for the government to engage in surveillance, it has to be conducted in a manner that provides protection to individual privacy. You know, there must be a level of probable cause. There must be judicial oversight of government action. And this is simply to prevent abuse. And this law doesn't have those protections.
Danielle, in 2006, the ACLU filed a lawsuit against the National Security Agency spying program. It was upheld, as I understand it, by a federal court, but the case was thrown out under appeal, and the Supreme Court declined to hear the case. Now, with this new lawsuit against the new FISA law, that's going to go before the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. I would think that there's a good possibility that this case will find itself before the Supreme Court. What are the precedents here, and what's the likelihood that the courts will uphold your objections of unconstitutionality in this new FISA law?
Well, you mentioned with our earlier challenge, it was upheld, and this was to the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program. The district court judge sided with us, finding our clients had standing to sue and that, in fact, the NSA's program was illegal. And then at the Sixth Circuit, there was a three-judge panel, and two of the judges sided with the government that our clients did not have standing to sue because they couldn't prove that they had been surveilled and that state secrets prevented them from showing it. So there's been four judges to consider widespread surveillance challenge, two of whom sided with us, and we, of course, think that they got it right, and two who sided against us. There's a couple things different in this challenge. First of all, this is a statute. It's not a secret program. There's absolutely no uncertainty about the vast sweep of this surveillance. In addition, the statute's not limited to suspected foreign agents. It implicates absolutely every domestic to international communication. And so what we've done is we've cobbled together a group of really prominent individuals and organizations, and we believe, as they do, that they have standing to challenge this lawsuit because they reasonably believe that their communications are going to be monitored under the law, and because this law makes them take costly and burdensome measures to protect the confidentiality of their communications. And that really is because of the people that they communicate with, the nature of their calls and emails, and and the regions that these communications are going into and out of. Because of all those things together, they have a reasonable belief that their communications are going to be intercepted, they're going to be searched, they're going to be read, retained, disseminated under this law. And as a result, they have a real claim to injury.
After the election of a new president and Congress this November, what remedies are possible, if there's the will, among these politicians to change the FISA law?
Well, certainly our legislative office is going to be lobbying and continues to lobby Congress very hard on these issues. I think that you're going to see a broad coalition of organizations that are speaking out against this law, that there will be probably numerous challenges to its constitutionality, both on the privacy aspect and also on the telecom provisions. And if we can get that push, you know, hopefully what we'll see is that Congress listens to the will of the people and writes new legislation that strikes the right balance and provides the protections that are necessary and honestly constitutionally mandated in the U.S.
That was ACLU staff attorney Danielle Tully. For more information on the group's FISA lawsuit, contact them at area code 202-457-0800 or visit their website at aclu.org. After decades of inaction, Congress has recognized the need to deal with carbon emissions, the main source of global climate change. Various bills have been introduced in this session of Congress. The Lieberman-Warner bill, which would have given away millions of dollars in carbon credits as an incentive to reduce overall emissions, was given the best chance of passage. But that bill was killed by Republican opposition. Other bills would sell carbon credits rather than giving them away, but those bills haven't made much progress either. Any proposals to tax the amount of carbon dioxide produced in order to encourage the reduction of carbon emissions have made no headway in Congress, despite strong support from former Vice President Al Gore and many scientists. Cecil Corbin Mark is policy director of We Act, a Harlem, New York-based environmental justice organization. His group joined with many others concerned about the disproportionate impact of pollution in general, and global warming in particular, on communities of color in the U.S. The group is part of the Environmental Justice Forum on Climate Change. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Corbin Mark, who explains why his group supports both a carbon tax and cap as a fairer, more transparent, less expensive way to reduce CO2 emissions.
A couple of reasons why we believe that a carbon tax is preferable to a cap and trade. First and foremost, we are groups representing the most impacted and the worst impacted communities, and those that are forecasted to be most impacted and worst impacted by all the sort of scientific community that is currently looking at the social and human impacts of global warming across the globe. So when we say first and worst impacted, it's not because we have described ourselves as being that way, but it actually is because the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has sort of come up with that in their research and work, recognizing that the world's poorest communities, the world's most vulnerable communities, are going to be the ones who are first and worst impacted. In the United States context, what that really means is communities of color, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, indigenous peoples, and low-income peoples, and that would also include low-income Caucasian brothers and sisters as well. So the communities that are most vulnerable in the United States context are those kinds of communities, right? And they're vulnerable for a variety of different reasons, because we often don't have the resources to adapt to climate change. We don't have the health insurance. We don't have, the ability to sort of move ourselves and be as mobile as other communities can be, because we don't have the capital to do that, or the, physical assets to help us move in some ways. Whether, you know, if you take the situation in Katrina, people didn't have cars. And so when we think about previous examples of how cap and trade systems have not benefited communities. We have only to look to examples of what Los Angeles, for example, there was a program called Reclaim that operated in the, I think it was the 70s and 80s was when Reclaim, I think, operated. And this was a program where they traded, you know, pollutants, and it actually resulted in low-income communities being very burdened by sort of false trading systems that basically said, well, we'll trade, you know, pollutants around, and essentially what it did was it ended up dumping pollution in low-income communities and communities that already had the poorest air quality versus, you know, sort of sharing that burden around.
Well, emissions trading systems have sometimes worked in the past, like the trading that reduced sulfur dioxide that caused acid rain, which has been greatly reduced through that system. I realize that for greenhouse gases, we're talking about a broader problem with many more sources of pollution. Cecil Corbin, Mark, can you just enumerate the reasons your organization is in favor of a tax and not carbon trading?
There are three clear reasons that we're in favor of a cap on emissions and a tax as opposed to a trading system. We believe that a tax is a system that can be implemented and is transparent enough for most Americans to understand what is happening with the revenues that are generated from the tax system. People understand that. We also believe that a tax and a cap will help us get to the emissions reductions that are necessary to stop cooking the planet. And we believe that a tax and a cap will really help us get this process up and running much smoother based on existing government infrastructure that's at hand. You know, we've had experiences with communities of color in the past where we have been literally and figuratively burned by trading systems, and we don't want to repeat that, especially when we know that a regulatory cap or regulations work much more effectively in terms of reducing pollution.
That was Cecil Corbin Mark, Policy Director of We Act, a Harlem-based environmental justice organization. Contact the group at area code 212-961-1000. Or visit the group's website at weact.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.